to open the House Committee on Business and Labor. And the first thing I'd like to tell, if there's anybody out there, we intend to carry over House Bill 2203 until...
Wednesday.
Until Wednesday. So if you're room just for that, I apologize to you. It happens sometimes, and you can come back Wednesday, and we'll hear you then. So, and then I'm going to open a work session for the purposes of creating bills of legislative concept drafts 2757 and 2819, and I would entertain a motion to do so.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Barton.
I move the committee accept LCs 2757 and 2819 as committee bills.
Representative Barton moves LC 2757 and LC 2819 to be made into committee bills. Is there any questions, comments, concerns? We all know that we're not bound to vote one way or the other on this. Is there any opposition to this? Seeing none, so moved. And I'll close the work session as well. And then I'm going to, members, I don't believe we're going to move anything today because we don't have all the information we need. But it, should I just?
Yeah.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2201. Tracy, you want to?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We first heard House Bill 2201 on January 28th. This bill is from the Employment Department. And refresh your memory, this bill changes the effective date of excluding certain corporate officers' work from UI tax and also limits the same exclusion for qualified members of an LLC to those owning at least 10% of the company. You have in front of you, members, two amendments. The dash one is from the Employment Department and changes the threshold for the LLC member exclusion to owning at least 1% of the company. The dash two amendment is from NFIB and removes the LLC member exclusion provision altogether.
All right, and you have someone that's going to come and shed some light on this.
Mm-hmm.
Who is it?
Jennifer.
Oh, yeah.
One of Mike.
Hey, Mike.
If you both want to, or one of you, or both of you, please.
It should be, do you have a copy of that?
I have a copy. I have one.
Whenever you're ready, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey representing NFIB. And you have before you two amendments. One amendment, I believe, is offered by the department for a 1% ownership in the company, a limited liability company. And NFIB is recommending that the language in line 13 and 14 be deleted so you go back to current law. I will say at the beginning that this isn't the biggest issue for us, so you can read between the lines on that. Albeit, we think the public policy is that makes sense, and we look at the language. And if you look at line 12, it says a limited liability company by a member, and the member is an individual who has an ownership interest in a limited liability company and all the rights and obligations of a member. And we read that to include voting rights because it does say in 63001 that a member does not include an assignee of an ownership interest who does not have voting rights. So with regard to this, we look at this as somebody who would be a manager or who would be a member of that organization who therefore would be exempt from unemployment and would have an understanding that they're exempt from unemployment compensation. Now, with regard to the 1%, quite frankly, we think you could play an array of different games with that with regard to what that 1% would look like. And at the end of the day, would you really have, depending on the legal structure, 1% of that particular company? So with that, Mr. Chair, hopefully that wasn't confusing, we prefer the Dash 2 amendment in the sense that we think current law works just fine here in Oregon.
And Mike, before I open to questions, I'm going to ask someone from the department to come up and give their side of all this, the original bill, either one or both of the amendments or anything that Mr. Dewey commented to, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rob Edwards, Unemployment Insurance Tax Manager for the Employment Department.
The reason that we proposed the legislation in the first place, this piece of it, is because we did have experience with a company. It was actually a trucking company that made all of their drivers members of the limited liability company. And we thought it would be good to have it in the statute that you needed some percentage of ownership, actual percentage of ownership, in order to make it clear that that was not a reasonable way to try and avoid your obligations as an employer as far as unemployment insurance is concerned.
Any questions of these gentlemen? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I'm hearing you say that these members can be performing work for the LLC and not be subject to the unemployment insurance rates or deductions for the trust fund. Essentially, so they're not being paid a wage. How are they being paid then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, in the case that I mentioned, they were in fact being paid a wage, but they had also signed an ownership agreement as a member of the LLC. The actual agreement showed that they were to pay less than 1%. And it was never specified exactly how much less than 1%. And the argument from the company was that since they had an ownership of some amount, that therefore they qualified as an LLC member and then were excluded under our statute from having to pay unemployment insurance on the wages they paid them.
Oh, well. So is that similar to a corporate structure? If you are a corporate owner and you actually work for the company and get paid for your work, are you exempt from the employment laws?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, yes, you are. You can be exempt under certain limited circumstances. The general rule is that corporate officers are included. The corporation does pay unemployment insurance tax on the wages paid to them for services as a corporate officer. Under certain limited circumstances, closely held family corporations can exclude their corporate officers, although they have to go through a process to do that. It's not automatic.
One more follow-up?
Please, go ahead.
So is the department in favor of which of these amendments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holdy, the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you.
And that's the 1%.
Mr. Chair, correct.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would prevent a company from saying, now you own 2%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, absolutely nothing. They could say that at any time. What we're hoping, though, with the number in statute, that it'll discourage people from going down that road.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, because I had the department in my office, I'll talk a little bit about this and follow up with Representative Holvey's line of questioning. I mean, a C corporation, obviously, it's different, completely different than a limited liability company. As a limited liability company is closer to a partnership in the way that employment laws operate. And there are so many ways that you can play with a limited liability company and membership much easier than you could in a C corporation that if people truly want to manipulate this, they will. And I think what we have in this situation is a company that's manipulated, and there ought to be some other thing we should be able to, as I look at this even deeper, there ought to be some other way we can go after somebody who's abusing the laws of a limited liability company or the formulation of a limited liability company and the fact that there should be operating agreements in place. There should be things that are up front. So is there any other ways that your department or other departments at the state have explored in going after these people who are abusing this particular situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, of course, if during the course of an audit or an investigation we discover that things are not as they should be, that is, for example, in the case of this truck company, the ownership interest was actually zero by these purported members, we have remedies for that. I think what we were trying to accomplish with the law is to get the number out there for everyone to see so they at least have a base to work from. We were hoping it would have more of a deterrent effect.
Yes. Rob, these truck drivers, did they enjoy the benefits of having theoretical ownership of part of the company? Did you end up saying no, they had to pay unemployment insurance benefits? How did this all end up?
Mr. Chair, that's exactly what happened. We discovered this during an audit. We assessed tax on those amounts that had paid the truck drivers. We said, no, this is a fiction. They are not really members of the LLC, even though they signed an agreement. They did not invest any money in the business. They did not reap any of the rewards of the profits. They were paid a flat-out wage. The company did appeal that, and we went through two levels of appeal, and we won at Court of Appeals.
So, if we add a 1% on there, these truck drivers would not have gotten the unemployment insurance. Is that correct?
If, in fact, they had really received 1% of the ownership, yes, that's correct.
If I may, again, Mike Dewey for the record, yes, a rhetorical question is, did these individuals have voting rights? And it sounds to me they didn't. And in order to be, the members have to have voting rights in order to not have coverage.
Well, not according to the results of this case, they didn't. So
that's my point. They didn't have voting rights.
I think there's already a process in place to make sure that they do get benefits without this legislation at 10% or 1%. And what I don't want to do is pass 1% and then have these truckers who, they may not even know what they're signing. Unfortunately, people don't read agreements, and there's been countless examples before us, including doctors and really smart people that don't pay attention to the things they sign and how it all turns out. So and members, we're not going to be moving this today, but I don't want to pass a law that says, okay, companies are allowed to say you're 1% owner, but you're really not. And when you go to file for unemployment insurance thinking you deserve it and you definitely need it, then all of a sudden they go, oh, no, you signed this saying you're part owner, even though there's no proof of that. I'm leery of all that, so I'm kind of leaning towards 0% at this point. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I tend to agree with you now, especially now that I've heard the fact that the department did, in fact, go all the way through and prove that these people were not legitimate members of a limited liability company. So it doesn't matter what the percentage is. They had to do their due diligence to prove it. And in this case, hats off to you for doing the job and collecting the money. And I think what we need to deal with is the people that abuse this stuff, go after them with the situations that we have versus changing the whole law that would set up something now maybe that somebody would actually not have to pay unemployment insurance and they didn't know it.
Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, I genuinely sympathize with you and Representative Cameron in this. This is actually, once you get into it and delve into the details, it is a little more complicated, perhaps. On one hand, what's the need for legislation, especially since the department actually prevailed through the process?
Right.
On the other hand, however, I am astonished that this only happened in one company. And I think that there is a legitimate concern that this kind of abuse of the LLC form. I do think that the 1% would deter further abuse, and I'm concerned that if we don't act, that this might become a pattern. Or indeed, I'm actually concerned that it's a bigger pattern than we are aware of right now. And so I'm conflicted. I'm not exactly sure. I'm going to keep thinking about this, but it's a close call.
Representative Kennemer.
With all due deference to the attorney from Hobbin, I guess, you know, my thinking about it is it seems that we've already established a court precedent. And when you change the number, you introduce the loophole and we get to start that procedure all over again. And I guess, you know, that's why I'm thinking I'm having trouble understanding that the fix fixes anything. It moves the standard. And we already have a court precedent at the appeals court level, right? So it's at the appeals court level. It seems to me that that's relatively decisive. The example cited is clearly an effort to in-run the law, and clearly that was picked up. It's too bad that it went to court, but it just seems to me that now that we have been successful. I think you introduced a whole new loophole. I guess that's.
Let me ask you a question of the department too, and then I'll go to Representative Barton. Okay, I'm a truck driver. I don't know what I'm into. I think I get unemployment insurance. Turns out the court says I do. Does the company have to pay all the court and interest on that money that was not paid at the rightful time? How's that work?
Mr. Chair, the way it works is, of course, if we do an audit and we do a tax assessment, there's interest associated with that. And okay. Statutory interest, the current rate is 18% a year. In addition, there's some penalties if you don't pay within a certain amount of time. Court costs, we are not able to recover.
You'd be rather foolish if you're an employer to try to do this if you aren't damn sure you're doing what's right. Well, Representative Barton.
A question. Did that Court of Appeals, did that generate a published opinion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, yes, it did.
I'd love to see that if you would.
We'll get it.
Thank you.
Why don't you just share that with all of us so we can
Very
all
good.
For bedtime reading. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at another part of the bill, if you changed in the scenario you just described, if you changed the liability to individuals who own at least a 1% or whatever number you're coming up with interest in the company, wouldn't they then be liable to pay it personally if the employer should happen to not come through?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, that is correct under the other section of the bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, follow
yes,
up.
Yes, please.
So somebody disowning 1% would be on the hook.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, let me clarify a little bit. The way we've written the liability portion of it, they would also have to be a responsible member. That is, they would have to be more than a member in name. They'd have to be a member who made a decision to, we call it prefer creditors. That is, who made the decision to pay something other than the taxes. So that's the person we would be looking for to hold personally liable.
Any further questions, gentlemen, ladies? Okay. All right.
Thank
thanks,
you
guys.
For your time.
We'll be. Pardon me. No, we're not doing anything today. We're not doing anything at all. Ever. I'm going to.
Good.
We're on.
Next. We're on.
Close work session on House Bill 2201. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2633.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2633 modifies the definition of a supervisory employee in public employee collective bargaining law to include certain individuals who have independent authority for personnel actions such as hiring, rewarding, or disciplining other employees.
And we're not going to work this one today either, folks, but we have a long list of folks that want to testify, so... I'd like to call Brian DeLashman and Bob Livingston, please. I'm gonna call. Is this a neutral?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian DeLashman. Lobbyist that most of you know, I represent on this particular issue the Oregon Council of Police Association, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, which is the state troopers, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, all combined roughly 7,000 to 7,500 employees in the state. Let me start off by indicating that House Bill 2633 is one of the top two priorities for all of these clients. It's an issue that has been circulating since the changes in the PECPA statutes, the Public Sector Collective Bargaining Statutes, in 1995.
Thank you.
Let me kind of do the very brief overview of what this bill does and maybe even talk about some of the arguments that you'll hear on both sides of this bill today. And then I'll leave actually the how it meets the road, what's going on out in the bargaining units to some officers that are in the building today, along with some attorneys that represent those officers as well. Post-1995, there was a shift in who could be in certain bargaining units. Prior to 1995, at least for the police side, sergeants were in fact in bargaining units around the state. Now, let me not mislead you that in every location since 1995, sergeants have been excluded from bargaining units, or there has been a massive shift. There are, however, jurisdictions in the state that have chosen prior to post-1995 to exclude sergeants from the bargaining units. For us, the issue is whether or not these folks really have the ability to meet the test of being able to hire, fire, lay out, discipline, or discharge, or whether in fact they're just in the line of command, and in fact whether they have the independent ability to do that, or they sometimes do that at the direction of somebody who is above them. Now, the one argument that you will hear in opposition to this, and I've heard it for a number of years, is this bill will, in fact, not just turn us back to prior to 1995, when sergeants were, in fact, allowed to be in the bargaining unit, but it will, in fact, open the floodgates, and that everybody all the way up to the mayor or the city council is, in fact, going to be in our bargaining units. Let me assure you that that was not the case prior to 1985, and that is not going to be the case this time. Quite frankly, the bargaining units would not like all those folks in their bargaining units. And there is a very clear distinction that we believe can be made between somebody that is essentially doing the same work as an officer that's in the bargaining unit, but may have some additional responsibilities, but doesn't have that independent ability to hand out those kinds of sanctions. The one last thing that I'll touch on is that we do know that there has not been a fiscal for this bill yet. You will get it. But let me assure you that, or give you a little preview of why there might be a fiscal on this, and kind of counter it ahead of time. The only way that there would be a fiscal on moving some folks from what is a salaried position, in my case a sergeant, let's say for OSP, or for a local county or city, back in the bargaining unit is that they would be shifting from a salaried position back into a position under collective bargaining in which they would be an hourly employee. And if they're going to tag a physical on this, the only reason they would tag a physical on this is because currently they can, in fact, work those sergeants without having to pay them overtime. So if they get a call out in the middle of the night, who do they call? They call the sergeant because they don't have to pay overtime. So excluding those folks from the bargaining unit may, in fact, be a fiscal advantage to the jurisdiction, but it is not, in fact, we believe, responsible management by the employer. We believe these folks, in fact, don't have that independent judgment. They are doing essentially the same job as the other bargaining unit members, and are being used as a way to get around paying overtime. With that, I'll let my friend and colleague Bob Livingston speak, and then we have a whole list of folks who will come and tell their story.
And Brian, just so you know, I'm going to kind of go back and forth on this to let proponents, then some opponents, then some proponents, then some opponents. Just to
you mean, Mr. Chair, the way we've orchestrated it with all of our folks signing up in a certain order is not going to work out?
And God bless all your members.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I'm not going to read my entire testimony. I think I'd like to just highlight a few things. Really, the attempt of what we're trying to accomplish here is to simply go back to a more traditional look of prior to 1995, what your bargaining units and whether it's public, police, fire, corrections, what it truly looked like. Really, the question I think you need to ask yourself is simply whether or not those people that are providing those frontline services that are doing the routine similar functions day in, day out, whether they should be in a bargaining union and therefore have a labor contract or not. Really, that's ultimately the question that you need to ask yourself. One of the things that you need to be cautious of, though, I think, in these discussions is I know Brian communicated a lot about specifics to sergeants. The reason, and this has been asked before, and this is why I'm mentioning it now, the reason that you can't go with specific definitions of whether it's a sergeant or a lieutenant or a fire captain is it really varies throughout each jurisdiction depending on size, geography, and really tradition in many senses. And so the reason for needing a fix specific to language in PECBA is because of just that, that there's very many different job titles, but yet, as an example, a lieutenant that's a fire lieutenant in Pendleton may do the very same function that a fire captain does in Medford. And so it's really hard to put into the statutes, and my research has shown me what they've done in other states where these people are traditionally part of bargaining units is that they define the functions of that. The other point that I just quickly like to point out too is I think you'll hear from the opponents that we absolutely have to have people that can settle grievances, that can handle discipline, and that can manage the organization. We would agree with that. The only thing I would remind you is in my 16-plus years in the fire service is that when it comes to discipline, when it comes to grievances, even those frontline supervisors, you might do that 0.1% of your entire career. The reality of it is what you're spending the majority of your time out there is serving the public in the capacity. If you're a police officer, it's out there responding to the day-to-day call and the needs of your community. Same thing for those individuals that are in the fire service. And the other thing that I think you need to keep in mind, and while I think you may there may be some confusion and maybe a few fakes here and there, ultimately these people are professionals. Whether it's the police officer or the firefighter, when the bell rings, we clearly know there's a certain chain of command that works. There's a certain hierarchy of authority, and every one of us know the responsibility and the duty to act. Whether you're in a bargaining unit, whether you have a contract or not, that's not what's on your mind day in, day out. When the bell rings, we're professionals. And irrespective of whether you're in the bargaining unit or out of the bargaining unit, the bottom line is we get the job done. So in closing, I think ultimately what we're asking for is those people that are doing similar work, that traditionally have done similar work. The question for you is do those people, particularly in these economic times, do they deserve to have the right to a contract and to bargain collectively? We believe that they do. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions of these gentlemen?
Well, we did a good job.
Hey, bless you. All right, then. I'm going to ask Adam Shanks and Tom Graham if they'd like to come on up. And before you gentlemen sit down, I don't think there's anybody up here that doesn't. As a matter of fact, I know there's no one up here that doesn't appreciate everything that our public safety officers do in this community, regardless of how they feel about this bill. So again, I want to thank all you men and women for doing your service, too. So,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Barton.
I actually haven't seen Mr. Shanks since high school in Newport, Oregon. Good to see you again, Adam.
Well, I could really take off on that one, considering my colorful youth, but I won't.
Yeah. Are there some stories we should know?
I'm talking about just me here, not my friend to my right here. Go ahead, gentlemen, whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Adam Shanks. I'm a patrol sergeant with the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. Today you'll hear from Sergeant Tom Graham as well as myself. We sit here before you today as members of a successful United Leadership Team in our office. It's built around one common goal. That's providing effective law enforcement services to our citizens. Management teams are developed to carry out the mission, directives, and goals of their employers. To do so effectively, these requirements must be carried out by all management employees free of any feeling of divided or false loyalty or conflict of interest. Management cohesiveness is essential to building a successful operation capable of delivering a quality service to its customers, or in our case, law enforcement services to our citizens. Placing any portion of our management team into a collective bargaining unit would severely hinder the ability of the affected members to carry out their duties without such feelings, if not at least in part. With regard to sergeants in our Lincoln County Sheriff's Office, we are responsible for all employees under our supervision. Our responsibilities include, but are not limited to, work assignments, employee guidance, coaching, scheduling of staff, maintaining confidential information related to those we supervise, discipline, and personnel evaluations. Many of these responsibilities are mandatory subjects of bargaining and represent a clear separation between us and the line staff we supervise. being placed in a collective bargaining unit would potentially cause some dysfunction and to struggle in carrying out our responsibilities in an effective manner. Members of collective bargaining units represent employees during disciplinary hearings, contract negotiations, and other job-related situations. While in these capacities, employee representatives often find themselves struggling with separating personal and professional views from the cause they're elected to protect and fight for, which in some cases may conflict with the mission of their employer. I can only imagine how pronounced the struggles could be from a supervisory role if we were placed or allowed into collective bargaining units. With that, I'd like to conclude a brief statement, though powerful in my eyes. It's our actual mission statement for the Sheriff's Office of our county. It is the mission of the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office to safeguard the lives and property of the people we serve, to reduce the incidence and fear of crime, and to enhance public safety while working in partnership with our citizens to improve their quality of life. It comes with this statement, or this statement is the reason I am here before you guys today, in opposition of House Bill 2633. The only other thing I'd like to add is I'd hope that you'll oppose it along with me as well. Thank you.
Chairman, committee members, for the record, I am Tom Graham. I hold the rank of sergeant with the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. I'm assigned to the corrections team. I'm one of two sergeants that work within our jail facility under the direction of our lieutenant. I come to you today, and I'm going to kind of freehand some points that come to my mind, because Sergeant Stanks did such a great job of articulating, I think, how we both feel. But we're a small office, and we have a very limited command structure. And when we assumed the rank of sergeant, we took on, I think, some traditional roles that the sergeant does, that daily leading stuff and assigning and directing the workflow, but we took on a large amount of administrative duties as well. And some of those things I wanted to share with you. I kind of laugh when we get to the issue of contract, because Sergeant Shanks and I both had the privilege of serving our local union at some point as contract negotiators. We now sit at times on the other side of the table and go, wow, how did we end up with that language? Oh, yeah, that was me. And that's a part of who we've become, because we have to sit down and look at the mission that our office has, and we go, well, sometimes that contract language is a direct conflict with what we're trying to accomplish, and we have to come to some sort of understanding, and we appreciate our negotiation process having sat on both sides of that. But it's an important part of who we are, and we can't have any false loyalties. We know what we're sitting at the table and what we're trying to accomplish. Sometimes we represent the employees. We sit down and meet with our association, and they find us more agreeable than they realize. And that's part of a culture that we're trying to establish within our organization. But again, as supervisors, we have that freedom to sit down and present the views of our administration and work those things out. Kind of going back to some of the roles that we have, I saw in this that they wanted to add the word independent, and I find that to be a little bit on the ambiguous side. In our organization, everybody has a boss, all the way up to my boss, the sheriff. He answers to the voters. So in some aspect, he doesn't necessarily have true independent authority to make decisions. While he makes decisions, and they're largely independent, there are some cases where he has to keep his contingent consideration. We make decisions daily that are very independent, but we still have employers that we have to respond to. And I think that that word opens a large box of interpretation. The second item was adding a line that says impose economic discipline as a defining phrase for a supervisor. Again, I felt that was kind of an arbitrary line. We do many things in our roles each day as a supervisor that are far more intrusive into employees' lives than imposing a discipline that may be economic. And I'm going to cite the example of internal affairs. Being a small office, Sergeant Shanks and I are responsible for internal affairs investigations. And when you're doing an internal affairs investigation on an employee, it's a very intrusive, sometimes, process. It's a very necessary process. It's going to determine whether or not that event occurred, whether or not that employee had something to do with it, or whether they need to be exonerated. We have to go into that with one mission in mind, and that's to determine what the truth and fact is. But that impacts the employee, because we're looking into their lives and their work performance. And I find that part of my job sometimes to be far more difficult than the end result. Sitting down and deciding a discipline is often, you know, a negotiated item sometimes. My final comments on being a supervisor is that we enjoy the freedom to make decisions each day about how the facility is going to run or how the division is going to operate. And sometimes we make unpleasant suggestions or decisions. I personally have been responsible for 3 reorganizations within our office, presented ideas by me that ultimately resulted in up to 15 layoffs. It was a necessary act to take to make sure that we were being efficient and responsible towards our citizens. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions of these? Representative Holby, these gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your testimony. It's a tough issue. But just regarding one of your last statements, Sergeant Graham, you had said you'd made recommendations that resulted in layoffs. Do you actually have the authority to hire or fire the individual employees of the Sheriff's Department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I have actually terminated employees. It is part of my job description. I sit on hiring panels and make decisions about the employees that we choose to hire.
So ultimately, it doesn't take the sheriff to hire or fire somebody. You could do that individually?
Yes.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you gave a couple of statements about you used the term false loyalty, and give me an example. I'm struggling a little bit with how being in the bargaining unit inherently leaves you conflicted any more than you're conflicted just because you work with your colleagues every day. You serve together, and I would assume share a sense of camaraderie with them through your service. To me, I mean, that would certainly leave me conflicted and has left me conflicted in the past when I've had to discipline employees and I've had to lay employees off just because I worked with them day in and day out. And it had nothing to do with whether or not I was in their bargaining unit. So, I mean, how is that? How does being, in your opinion, how does being in the bargaining unit, how is that inherently the genesis of the conflict of interest?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I think I'll give a real-life example of the conflict I've seen as recent. We actually have what we call supervisors within our collective bargaining unit. They hold the rank of corporal. We elected to negotiate it that way and allow them to be part of that collective bargaining unit. We hold a monthly management meeting, and it involves our corporals, and we sit down and talk about operations. We were talking about some sensitive material, and one of our corporals felt an obligation to report that information to the association president and was doing so during the meeting via text message. One of the things we do is we have to define what's confidential in those meetings, and that had been done. Subsequently, when I spoke with that corporal about divulging that, because that information wasn't ready for release. We were having a preliminary discussion about an operational change, and I asked him why he did that. Well, it was a union issue. I needed to make him aware of it. Well, we told you that was a piece of confidential information at that time, and we would release it when appropriate. And so there was a conflict for that employee. I mean, he felt obligated as an association member to get that information to them as quickly as possible. But in the same aspect, we hadn't made a final decision. We were discussing an ideal or change to how we were going to do things, and when that decision was ready, we would present it to the association.
Yes, please, go ahead.
So if we were to pass this bill and it simply puts you working under different ground rules, and you can expect that those ground rules are different, then can you not preemptively address, and perhaps some of it gets into the actual language of the contract, but can you not address those type of issues with sergeants in this particular case ahead of time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, I think that you actually hit on the point is that we can negotiate those items within our contract. Having the, as a small agency, the ability to determine how our work flows and how our members serve is a real benefit to us. We can sit down with our association and say, look, if we want sergeants in our association, we can make that choice. On the note of overtime, and change subject for just a moment, we're actually paid overtime. Our management allows that for our supervisors. So that decision was made at our management level, and that's part of our culture. I'm not sure that I definitely just don't agree with changing the law to say that this is what a supervisor is. Allowing an agency to determine that, I think, is crucial. Thank you.
I'm glad to hear you're paid overtime. Representative Edwards, are you satisfied with that?
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Thatcher, then Esquivel, then Matthews.
Are you supervisory, sir?
I'm doing my best.
Okay.
But I don't think this bill brings me into a collective bargaining unit. But
yeah, I don't know. We should talk about that. Thank you for your testimony. And I'm just wanting to kind of picture, you know, your office and how this would affect you. Would you be reclassified under this bill, or would how many people would come under, bargaining unit rather than being determined as supervisory in your particular world here? Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I believe it's defined by job description, and in our office, based on the line drawn in the sand, quote-unquote, of the monetary sanction language that is in the proposed statute or bill, our sergeant levels would still most likely not be able to be represented employees in a collective bargaining unit based on definition, which brings me back to a point of this, the concerns I think that the proponents of this bill have, in my opinion, are more from an organizational standpoint, not the system itself. I think it's individual organizations that that need to redefine how they do business, so to speak. As Sergeant Graham said, our culture is we as sergeants, we have basically the same benefits as our association members, with the exception of a few here and there. But we are paid overtime. We are well cared for from our management positions. And for those reasons alone, I believe it's an organizational issue more than it is the system and the statutes that outline what the current language is for this topic.
Representative Esquivel.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has been answered.
Oh, thank you very much. Representative Matthews.
I guess a couple comments and then a question, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Thank you. Sergeant Shanks, your mission statement, I assume, applies to every individual that works for the deputy or the sheriff's office, not just management team. So that's something that's carried out throughout all ranks. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, that's correct.
Okay. You know, I personally have a problem with this false loyalty idea, both of you being union representatives at some point in your bargaining unit. I think you know that it's about, representing a process and supporting a process, not necessarily a person. I could see where you could be conflicted from times, but I have a hard time believing you never separated yourself from that. I'm just kind of curious, what exactly is the rank structure? This is for either one of you. What is your rank structure in your organization right now? How does that play out? Because you sit here and testify as sergeants, and I'm just curious if you have any idea what kind of impact that has on other organizations that are set up differently than yours, yet sergeants wear the same rank but perform different duties. So how are you set up in your rank structure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, our rank structure is deputy, corporal, sergeant, and then lieutenant. Lieutenants represent the divisions within our sheriff's office, and they answer directly to the sheriff.
Okay, and so, you know, just for point of clarification, Mr. Chair, thank you. It seems to me like even before, you know, this Senate Bill 750, you would still be outside your bargaining unit in your current capacity as a sergeant in your organization. So you can say it's organizational, but actually it's a statewide problem within law enforcement, public safety, firefighters, because not everybody's set up the same way. Often people have patrol officer, then sergeant, then lieutenant, and then perhaps captain. And so in your organization, it's probably you never would impact been impacting the language in the first place. And that's why I think this language comes to us, is to go back to the way it was, which wouldn't have had any impact on you in your current position. Does that make sense, Sergeant?
I understand what you're saying, sir.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Any further questions of these gentlemen? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right. Let me make sure I'm doing this right. I'd like Will Atchison at Hess, please. Whenever you're ready, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Will Atchison. I'm one of the lawyers that Brian DeLashmuth promised you, and here I am. Just the briefest of backgrounds, for 29 years, I've represented the Portland Police Association and the Multnomah County Deputy Sheriff's Association. I have in my career represented over 120 police and fire unions around the West. In addition to being a lawyer for the unions, I'm somewhat of a teacher and interested in this. I've written 8 books on public safety labor relations, and I teach in the area of collective bargaining, both management and labor groups on a national level. The only other piece of background is, like, I recognize at least one of you, and I hope I'm not slighting any others. I was here when Senate Bill 750 was being considered and was being debated, and in fact testified in the legislature on Senate Bill 750. I have 3 points that I'd like to make for you. The first is, I'd like to give you a national perspective, so we're not just Oregon-centric here, a national perspective on public employment collective bargaining laws and where the lines are drawn with respect to supervisory employees. The second point that I'd like to make is to address what the 2 sergeants from Lincoln County just discussed, and whether or not there is evidence, both on a national and an Oregon level, of divided loyalties and conflicts of interest when first-line supervisors are included in a bargaining unit. And then lastly, I'd like to share with you my view of the history of Senate Bill 750 and how this came to be law. First of all, from a national perspective, just by way of reminder, our Collective Bargaining Act came into existence in Oregon in 1973. It was one of the later statewide collective bargaining laws that are out there, passed at the same time as Washington's. What is unusual about Oregon today is the product of Senate Bill 750 in terms of the composition of bargaining units. No other state in the country draws the line where Oregon draws it. In Washington, in the police end, and I represent police officers in Oregon, individuals who hold the rank up to and including captain are allowed to be in police bargaining units. The higher level supervisors are compelled to be in a different bargaining unit than rank and file members, and you see that line drawn, for example, in Seattle, where officers and sergeants are in one bargaining unit and lieutenants and captain are in another. In California, the line is drawn, depends on the jurisdiction, somewhere around the rank of lieutenant. The president of one of my clients, the Anchorage Police Association, is and has been for many years a sergeant. In Hawaii, it's lieutenants. The states that have had the collective bargaining laws for the longest, Michigan, New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, you see sergeants, lieutenants, and even above in collective bargaining units. Oregon is the anomaly with respect to the treatment of first-line supervisors and what you might think of in traditional labor terms as the lead person in the bargaining unit. It's an anomaly in that it excludes them from collective bargaining. The second point that I wanted to make is whether or not you do see any evidence of this conflict of interest. And we can see this, whether or not this exists, really from two perspectives. The first is the pre-Oregon 1995 experience, when we did have sergeants in collective bargaining units. And the other is the experience you can just go out there and see today in a Washington or a California or Nevada or wherever you might be looking. And the answer is that you don't see those conflicts. Not only are police officers completely able to put aside any issues of divided loyalty, sergeants who are sitting in a staff meeting know who their boss is and know where their loyalties are. Not only are they able to do that, they're very capable of segregating when it is they have their union hat on and when it is they have their employer hat on. I will tell you that in my practice, the most successful presidents of police unions that I've seen have been sergeants. And the reason is they're natural leaders. They rise to the top. They have the respect and confidence of the people who elect them and the respect and confidence of the individual who promoted them. Now, beyond the issue of whether you see any divided loyalties just in day-to-day out there, I encourage anybody to look back over the ERB case reports prior to 1995. In fact, you didn't see evidence of it in any of the board's decisions concerning, this is called unit clarification, who comes in and who comes out of a particular bargaining unit. And there were times when you had hotly debated issues before the ERB as to whether sergeants should be in or out. I was involved in the Oregon State Police Officers Association case on that issue. There was no evidence of divided loyalties where that actually occurred. I'm completely concerned about the notion that a sergeant would come out of a staff meeting or simultaneously in a staff meeting leak information out of that meeting. That happens no matter what the rank of the individual is. That's a matter of individual control. The last thing I'd like to talk about is Senate Bill 750 that changed the playing field. When Senate Bill 750 was being considered by this legislature, this was not an issue that was on the radar screen. And those of you who were around for that time can bolster what I have to say. This legislature was concerned with three things primarily when it was considering Senate Bill 750. The first was the issue of the scope of bargaining. What is it a union has the right to bargain over? What is it that's a purely management right? The second issue was there were a series of disciplinary decisions from arbitrators that concerned the legislature, one in particular involving the Oregon State Police, where it involved sex on duty. And this legislature probably actually was, in the hearings where I participated, actually was more concerned about that issue than any other with respect to Senate Bill 750, and it enacted in Senate Bill 750 restrictions on an arbitrator's ability to overturn an employer's decision. The third issue that the legislature was concerned with was whether the deck was stacked in terms of what's called interest arbitration. That's the arbitration over what the contract should be. So where you give an arbitrator, because police officers and firefighters can't strike, you give the arbitrator the ability to set wages and benefits, there was a concern that the deck was stacked in favor of employees and the legislature wanted to realign that. Those were the focuses of this legislature at the time of Senate Bill 750. And when Senate Bill 750 left the legislature, it was substantially rewritten in the governor's office and came back to the legislature in a hugely modified form. I can't speak for anybody who voted on Senate Bill 750, but as one who observed it, I thought that the amendments that dealt with supervisory employees that resulted in sergeants being able to be taken out of a bargaining unit were almost accidental in the way that they came about, that they were not the focus of this legislature. Well, I want to close by reminding you that this bill does not change the definition of what a confidential employee is, who will remain excluded from collective bargaining. That definition allows an employer to exclude from bargaining anybody who formulates or effectuates management's policies with respect to labor relations. If you have sergeants who sit on a bargaining team for management, they won't be in a collective bargaining unit under this bill, under the bill's redefinition of the term of supervisor. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good morning, and it's my privilege to be here to speak with you and ask your support of House Bill 2633. My name is Patrick Kast. I'm a veteran police officer of over 30 years' experience. I'm currently an officer with the Hillsborough Police Department and president of the Hillsborough Police Officers Association, the HPOA, and I represent approximately 125 men and women in the Hillsborough Police Department. We're also a member of the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Like most men and women in law enforcement, as I gained experience and maturity in my career, I wanted to advance. The traditional method of advancement is to leave the protected ranks of officer and promote to unrepresented supervision. I sought promotion to sergeant and was successful. I was excited to be entering a world where I was promised I'd be taken care of and would have the opportunity as a formal leader to lead and shape the organization. After an initial period of being very excited about my new position and settling into my rank of sergeant, I quickly discovered I didn't have the authority I thought I would. While I believed I could really make a difference and be involved in setting direction for the organization, I found that pretty much all I did was what I did as a police officer, in addition to filling out shift rosters, reading police reports, assigning districts, and giving advice to the officers on my shift. I could approve time off as long as it fell within strict guidelines. If outside those guidelines, I would have to defer to a lieutenant. I could assign and approve overtime, again, under strict guidelines. I quickly learned that decision outside the strict parameters given was not always in my best interest. At major crime scenes or incidents on duty, my duty there as a sergeant was to make sure that another ranking of person of the department was there to take charge of the situation. At management meetings, input from sergeants was taken, but generally we were just there and given direction by upper managers. We were told that we could not be part of the discussion between lieutenants and upper managers because many times those discussions turns to matters of personnel issues, which we should not be privy to. We were told to think outside the box as long as our thoughts were very deep within the box that we were put into as sergeants. As a sergeant, I have no responsibility for disciplining employees and no authority to do so. That continues today. Although as a sergeant, I was charged with the responsibility of making sure everything was done right by the people in my charge, the authority to make it happen was pretty much non-existent. Other than pulling an employee aside and bringing errors or areas of improvement to their attention, everything discipline-related was conducted by a lieutenant or another officer, a person of higher rank. Even documented counseling letters which could be issued by me were closely scrutinized and sometimes actually performed by a lieutenant. As sergeants, we were in no position to rock the boat. Although we were assured we would be treated fairly in discipline or civil actions, the fact was that any legal representation would be our own financial responsibility. But I persevered and was promoted to lieutenant. Even at the mid-management level, I did not have the authority to discipline. Any action more severe than documented counseling had to be approved by upper managers. I soon learned that not having representation in disciplinary matters would be costly. In brief, a decision by upper management to terminate a probationary employee in my charge resulted in a lawsuit against the city by that employee. I naively believed the city would protect me in a suit. They did not. Instead, they also filed a case against me and elected to relieve me of my rank to help pacify the plaintiff. I was not afforded due process. The attorney who I thought was representing my interest was only looking out for the city. Although I had good reason to believe the city would not be successful in a legal fight, I chose to return to the protected officer rank where, quite frankly, I have more autonomy and more decision-making authority. I also have the backing of a collective bargaining agreement that assures me due process. An added benefit to that in being a member of the HPOA is legal insurance purchased by the HPOA. As I look back on my experience and job responsibilities, especially as a first-line supervisor, I see little difference between police officers and sergeants in my agency. Most sergeants still find themselves doing the work of police officers in addition to the clerical and administrative responsibility of their rank of sergeant. Sergeants in Hillsborough Police Department do not have the authority to administer discipline, hire or fire employees, or transfer employees to other work groups. As a representative of the members of the Hillsborough Police Officers Association in disciplinary matters, I rarely deal with a sergeant in disciplinary issues or matter of policy. Nearly all of my labor relations and disciplinary representation is with an upper manager. In theory, we believe our sergeants are supervisors with supervisory authority. In reality, they're a little more than lead workers. Lead workers directing employees and are charged to where, when, and how to conduct business. In theory, we believe our sergeants have the ability to discipline employees. In reality, they don't. Case in point, recently an officer represented by the HPOA was alleged to have disobeyed the direction of a sergeant. The officer received a letter of reprimand written and administered by a lieutenant. In theory, we believe sergeants set the directions at their agencies. In reality, they follow directions and work within a strict structure of guidelines and policy directed by upper managers. In theory, sergeants are guaranteed representation in civil criminal matters. In reality, at least at my agency, no specific protocol is in place. Case in point, in summer of 2008, I was out of town on vacation. At about 3:21 morning, I was awakened by a phone call from an on-duty officer informing me that it was an officer-involved shooting incident in our community. It was related to a domestic disturbance, and an HPOA member was probably involved. From 750 miles away, I made three phone calls, and within 20 minutes, our labor attorney and two HPOA representatives were on scene to represent any HPOA members who may have been involved. Once on the scene, they quickly learned that an HPOA member was not involved in the actual shooting, but it was a sergeant. The sergeant responded to the call to service to assist the primary officers on scene and aid an investigation, and was placed in a position of using deadly physical force against the suspect. Within an hour after the incident, HPOA attorney and reps did what was necessary to protect the officer. The sergeant, however, did not receive the same representation. While the sergeant was in fact acting in his capacity as a lead worker, responding to the same call, and being exposed to the same risks of the represented employees in his charge, there was no plan in place for him. No plan by the city to protect his rights, even though he was doing the same job as represented by the HPOA members. This isn't fair, and this isn't right. There are several officers and detectives in my department who are highly qualified and would make outstanding sergeants, but they are not willing to promote because of the loss of representation. They're not willing to accept the responsibility without the authority. They're not willing to lose benefits, especially in this time of economic uncertainty. They're not willing to trust that a department head will bargain for the benefit of their non-represented employees as hard as they bargain for their own. They're not willing to accept the risk of being left hung out to dry by administrators who are trying to protect themselves. This means that officers and detectives less qualified than their peers are being promoted to lead or to supervisory positions. This practice is bad for not only the organization, but for the community as well. As the face of local government, police departments should be led by the most qualified people. Those leaders should not have to lose representation because their job description does not match their authority. I'm sure you'll hear a different point of view from lobbyists, upper managers, and others today, including my deputy chief. I can respect their desire to protect their interest, but this bill is not about their interest. It's about the interest and protection of a group of men and women who deserve more than they're getting. And on this, I speak from experience. Thank you for your time, and I ask that you support House Bill 2633.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Representative Barton.
Mr. Atchison, I wanted you to know how much I appreciate your testimony. In fact, when I was preparing for this testimony, for this bill last night, I was actually hoping you would come and testify on this. Your reputation as an expert, the expert on this matter, is well known in the legal community. And so I appreciate your perspective. Also, I think, granted, I've only been in this job about 6 weeks now, but that is some of the most persuasive and cogent testimony I've heard. You made three very powerful arguments, and I appreciate it.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Barton.
Representative Kinnemer.
Mr. Chairman, I thought maybe it would be good to make a disclosure here. Mr. Atchison suggested that there might have been someone who was involved in Senate Bill 250, 750, and I was. I did cast an affirmative vote in 95 on that topic. Frankly, my memory of the specifics of the bill is not good because I did not serve on the committee. So I will be doing a little research here to see. I frankly don't recall these detail about at this point about bargaining units and whether that was a consideration at the time.
Well, Representative, this member certainly will not hold it against you for not remembering details from all those years ago when, be quite frank with you, I'm so crushed with details I can't remember one day from the next sometimes, and that's why I have the best committee administrator in the state of Oregon to keep me on focus and on the straight line here. But I do appreciate your comments. So, Representative Matthews, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you for your comments on behalf of the Hillsborough police officers, and you brought up a very good point that I want to make sure everybody kind of understood, and that is, in terms of succession planning, it's not so much about bargaining, but it's employees seeing the opportunity to move throughout the structure, represent their community, and these are the same folks who have been protecting it for years, and to discourage those very well-qualified and capable employees from promoting up within is something that I'm very concerned about. So I appreciate you bringing that point forward, and in terms of the succession planning and the impact it has on the organization and overall the community. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, thank you.
And any further questions, these gentlemen, before I make a comment? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Kind of building on what Representative Matthews was saying, at what point, okay, you're talking about promotion within and that there's not a desire to promote because then the benefits decrease and you're not represented and you don't have the same protections. Where would you draw that line? I mean, eventually you might promote up to at a level that you are talking about that is, you would not argue as being management. Are you saying, I'm just wondering, where would you draw that line? Because is it in this bill here? Is it in the bill that you're talking about, 2633? Or is it, are we going to eventually be talking about getting everybody into the same bargaining unit simply because people don't want to promote?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I believe Mr. Delishman made it clear in the beginning that it was not our intention to get everybody into a bargaining unit. However, and many things, I think, vary from organization to organization. However, at the Hillsborough Police Department, there's a clear distinction between sergeants and lieutenants and their authority. So I believe in our organization, so they would actually stop at the lieutenant rank.
Mr. Chair,
if you'd like to, please.
Representative Thatcher, I think what the big concern is you don't want to cut it off at the first step of the spigot, and that's what you see happen. I told you I represented Anchorage, and the sergeant there was president for many years. He's now the most successful police chief of the municipality of Anchorage. And had sergeants not been represented in Anchorage, he's best man at my wedding, I can tell you for sure, he wouldn't have taken a promotion. That's what you're concerned with here, is this large group of first-level line supervisors, lead people, whatever you want to call them, you don't want to deter their decision-making. As you go up the chain of command, it becomes much, much narrower. Sure, people take their chances once they get up there. But don't stop them at, 8 years of service.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kinnemer.
Mr. Richardson, just one more question, I guess, and I really don't know the answer to this. I just wonder if the size of the departments doesn't likely have a significant impact on this discussion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kinnemer, I agree with you completely. I think if you get to a small department, and also it depends upon department philosophy, you may well still see sergeants excluded from bargaining units under this statute, because sergeants will have the ability to hire and fire. They'll have the ability to make economic decisions.
So this provides for that exclusion?
That's correct.
And correct me, but we have perfect examples between Hillsborough and Lincoln County, examples where that exclusion would come into play.
That's correct.
Okay. Any further questions, ladies and gentlemen? All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have four in an hour. I have seven more people. So if it's already been said, don't say it again. I beg you. But we want to hear from everybody. We are going to now hear from the good Deputy Chief Chris Skinner and Ann Hannes, please. Whoever wants to go first, please go right ahead.
Well, good morning to you all. It's particularly fitting that I follow up my esteemed colleague, President Pat Hess of the HPOA, and I'm certainly not going to make this a rebuttal of what he had to say. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Chris Skinner. I am the Deputy Chief of Police for the City of Hillsborough, and here on behalf of that organization and Chief Lila Ashenbrenner that sends her regards. My unique perspective this morning is going to be rooted in a culture that we have at Hillsborough Police Department. I certainly want you to understand that this is not necessarily how other organizations' culture is ran or understands it to be. But I thought it was important for me to come down and talk a little bit about perspective from management with Hillsborough Police Department. First of all, let me say that one of our main priorities is our good relationship with our labor union. Collective bargaining is important in our organization. We see it as an opportunity for them to be a voice in the direction of the organization. They challenge us to make good decisions on behalf of the organization. And I would guess that Officer Hess and their attorneys would say that our relationship is better than most in the area, and we are certainly proud of that. There's no question about that. A couple of concerns that I have that I'd like to bring to your attention is the proposed bill may be specific to an individual situation, for instance. I'm not sure that there hasn't been a few instances that are specific to organizations that are suffering from some inequities or unfairness within their organization that this bill may be proposed to solve. And I would submit that maybe it is an organizational issue and not necessarily a systematic issue or flaw with the current bill as it stands. The bill speaks specifically about imposing economic sanction or economic discipline. And the concept of economic discipline doesn't necessarily always reside with what we traditionally see as a management employee. I think you heard earlier that oftentimes a chief sheriff or command-level executive needs to have permission from a city manager, council, or board of directors before they can impose economic sanction. And so I think there may be some ambiguity there as we look at the proposed language in that bill. There's no evidence for me, from my perspective, again, there's no evidence for me that the system is not working as it currently stands. It seems to mirror federal law and lend stability, minimizes uncertainty of interpretation, and contributes to labor peace, and also may reduce expensive litigation as it stands. I would suggest that certain instances of inequity and unfairness are the result of, again, organizational issues as opposed to a flawed system. Supervisors currently that have made that decision to promote or to put themselves in a situation to be promoted have distinguished themselves in their work. They have the ability to take care of themselves without depending on the pressure of the collective action. No one forced them to become supervisors. They abandoned the collective security of the rank and file voluntarily because they believed the opportunities thus open to them to be more valuable to them than such security. It seems wrong to subject those people of this kind who have demonstrated their initiative, ambition, and their ability to get ahead to the leveling processes of seniority, uniformity, and standardization that the Supreme Court recognizes as being the fundamental principles of unionism. Lastly, I want to talk a little bit about the ever-changing landscape as I see it. We are hiring more and more individuals with less life experience that are younger than ever before. I often sit on panels and make decisions about hiring, and it's amazing to me how inexperienced these people are coming to us asking for jobs in law enforcement that we are entrusting our civil liberties, civil rights to these people. Our first-line supervisors are the cornerstone of maintaining the importance and making sure that those civil liberties, civil rights are maintained out on the street. Our sergeants provide for professional development for their employees, address professional and behavioral concerns, They coordinate with the community. They listen to the concerns of the community. They develop action plans. They make recommendations about how to solve those problems with the community. And they're regularly charged with the training of officers on issues such as use of force, misuse of force, performance expectations, and officer misconduct. They clearly communicate the mission and the vision of the organization to the employees. Command-level executives must have the trust and confidence in their sergeants to know that their loyalties are not divided between management and union agenda, whether that be real or perceived based on management's perspective. I believe that the public trust, civil rights, and the preservation of civil liberties are best served when our first-line supervisors avoid any such conflict. Recently, I had an opportunity to engage in an exercise with our sergeants. A couple of months ago, I recognized that our group of sergeants is fairly large. We exercise a broad spectrum of supervision with our people. And because of that, I feel that we have been successful in staying out of litigation and out of the paper for negative incidences with the public. I brought the sergeants together, and we talked a little bit about what their role was in the organization as far as leaders. And interestingly enough, the conversation didn't center around basic supervisory responsibilities, the signing of overtime slips, or the do's and the don'ts of basic supervisory types of functions. But it centered around leadership, and it centered around how they wanted to create a want-to environment for their employees versus a have-to environment for their employees. We all recognize that by the order of the rank structure, have-to does exist from time to time, but the whole point is that we want our employees to want to work for us. They talked about things such as career development and mentorship and succession planning. They talked about very deep concepts that are very near and dear to the heart of management as we look at treating both our internal and external customers the same. One of the sergeants talked to me later about wanting to develop herself to move to the next level as a lieutenant and what that meant, and wanted to be more involved in internal affairs investigations and have the ability to make good decisions on behalf of employees below her and develop those employees so that someday they would want to choose to take her place as she moved up the chain of command. So in conclusion, I would like to just point out that I thank you for the opportunity to come and share a little bit about my organization, about the culture that we've built, the fact that it does work. I know that with difficult times come difficult decisions, and there's certainly plenty of decisions to be made in these economic times. In the grand scheme of all the challenges facing this legislation, I just would simply ask that you just give careful thought when it comes to making a decision with regard to this piece of labor legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ann, go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ann Hannis. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. You've already heard concerns today regarding the terms independent and potential conflict of interest. One of the things I do want to note is that counties vary greatly in terms of their size and circumstance, and also with the organizations within those counties, large and small. We're concerned that some of these issues could have implications on the counties and how they are managed and their flexibility. For example, a narrowing of the definition could result in elevating disputes much more quickly, and a principle of labor law is to resolve conflicts at the lowest level as soon as possible. And especially during these economic times when we're dealing with probably increased disputes, it's important to be able to resolve those conflicts at the lowest levels and to do so quickly and fairly. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions of these good people? Representative.
I guess I just wanted to make a comment as a former county commissioner, and one of the things that was a real management issue of the larger perspective of the county was the issue of overtime in the sheriff's department. And one of the advantages of having sergeants not part of the bargaining unit, well, let's see, we had sergeants as part of our bargaining unit, come think of it, but lieutenants and management staff, was the overtime issue, because that overtime issue in a large department gets to be a huge amount. And hopefully those officers are compensated at a higher level that is equivalent, but it gives you a firm figure, so when you're budgeting, it makes a significant difference. Whereas if it's overtime, some games get run a lot of times, and we don't usually talk about that publicly, but people cancel at the last minute, all kinds of interesting things happen, and it adds a certain element of certainty in very large budgets that's a key part of trying to make things work in these difficult financial times.
Sorry, but I just thought it was important to share that.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Thatcher, then Representative Cameron, then Matthews.
Thank you, Chris, right?
Yes.
Thank you. Now, you're Deputy Chief of Police. Did you promote from within, or were you recruited? If you were, was it because there weren't qualified people within the division? I'm just wondering.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, that I'm a little bit of a unique situation. I came from the Benton County Sheriff's Office in 2001 as a lieutenant. Prior to that, I was a unrepresented sergeant at the Sheriff's Office, working in that capacity, and have promoted up through the ranks at Hillsborough Police Department since 2001 to Deputy Chief of Police, where I currently reside. The other interesting point that I would make in light of some testimony you've already heard is our last sergeant process yielded as many as 15 candidates for the process for only two or three positions. I would submit that we have plenty of good candidates as we're trying to select, and people are making the choice to leave the collective bargaining unit to be able to seek promotional opportunities within our organization. Now, having said that, I will also recognize that our culture may be a little different because we've made a firm commitment to our people to try and maintain the gaps for pay between officer and sergeant so that there's no economic sanction to take that promotion. And we offer our sergeants overtime, understanding that that's going to be incurred from time to time so that there is not an inequity between the collective bargaining members and our sergeants. So I'm very proud of the fact that we have consistently a large pool and deep pool of applicants to choose from when we're looking at promoting from officer to sergeant.
Just one follow-up. Did you start out with Hillsborough as a representative employee or not?
I did not. No, ma'am.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Well, thank you. As a representative, just asked one of the questions. How many open spots? You don't have any open spots, right? As for sergeants, because you just said you had 15 applicants for...
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, that's correct. We have filled all of our sergeants' positions with candidates and oftentimes have a list that we draw upon for candidates.
Follow-up, if I may. The last question would be, what kind of process do you have for sergeants that are in those positions that have issues? Obviously, we heard some issues of maybe protection under certain situations to get feedback and to address those particular problems they may have. Can you talk about any of those things that you've listened to and made changes as a result of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, if I'm understanding your question correctly, you're talking about disciplinary types of issues with our sergeants?
Well, one of the things we heard earlier was a unrepresented officer in a shooting, for example, and not having an attorney there to represent him or her. Is that an issue with your sergeant group, and if so, how have you dealt with it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, it certainly could be an issue. We're talking about a very low-frequency, high-risk type of situation where a sergeant would be placed in that. But nonetheless, I don't want to give you the impression that that couldn't happen, because certainly it has recently where we've had a sergeant involved in a critical incident. One of the things that Hillsborough Police Department has always tried to strive itself to adhere to is an equal to or better than type of policy with our union. Certainly when it comes to economics, that's difficult with City Hall largely dictating how we would treat those people. With respect to internal processes for discipline or this particular incident, it's an organic situation for us to constantly try and provide the protections that a sergeant would need if involved in a critical incident. To include recently a policy that has been written that outlines specific steps that will be taken to make sure that his or her due process rights are safeguarded. Certainly this is a situation that may have snuck up on us because we spend an awful lot of time looking at our frontline people being involved in those kinds of critical incidents. This particular sergeant was afforded due process. I think if he were here today, would tell you that he was treated fairly and honorably through the process, up to and including a look by the grand jury, if so, on whether the shooting was justified. So it's a constantly evolving process for us to make sure that it mirrors what we do for our police officers.
Thank you. Thank you for your service. Yeah,
thank you so much.
Representative Matthews.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I just want to respectfully add that Representative Kenner made a comment about the advantage of a non-bargaining unit employee in terms of overtime or not paying overtime. It's important to note that a lot of the non-bargaining unit positions are not frontline, mandatory staffing, minimum staffing positions. So they also have the opportunity to flex time, where a lot of people don't. I don't necessarily know if that's the case. So thanks, Mr. Chair. And if you'll just please allow one question.
Yep, please.
Thank you, sir. So in your organization, you only had 15 people apply for sergeants. Is it your understanding that you are getting your best officers applying, or are there cases where some of your most senior officers just aren't interested in taking the promotion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, it's kind of a combination of both. Sometimes our most senior officers aren't the best candidates to be a sergeant. The more gray hair you have doesn't necessarily make you qualified to be a really good leader of people. I would submit that we
just
are,
a minute. Is this getting personal?
Yeah, Representative Martin agrees with that.
I'm blonde. I'm blonde.
Let's see. We should do ranking on gray hair, perhaps, up here. That could work.
Okay. But I feel really good about the pool of sergeants that we have promoted as of recent. We've got bright, intelligent individuals, both men and women, that have been excellent leaders for us. And so I am very, very pleased with the direction the organization's going and the culture that we've built that allows us to have such a deep pool of applicants.
Mr. Chair, and the reason I ask that question is you're exactly right. I think we're all experienced. A lot of applicants in public safety right now don't have a lot of life experience. They're fresh out of college, fresh out of school, nothing wrong with that. But trying to find that balance, and sometimes when they meet their minimum qualification, the other one's taking that test, they may do well in the process, doesn't necessarily make them the most qualified to take that promotion. And they're most senior guys are under the charge. I'm not suggesting those that serve longer actually accomplish more. I'm not suggesting that at all. So I appreciate your comment. Thank you, sir.
Representative Kennemer.
Mr. Skinner, I just had a question. How are you doing on recruiting qualified entry-level applicants? I know in Clackamas County that was, well, we were always on the short end of that stick. There just aren't enough trained applicants applying.
Mr. Chair,
at least that was my intention.
Recruitment and retention is the number one challenge facing every public safety agency, especially law enforcement today. We struggle daily to get bodies through the door that we feel like have the ability to hold the rank of police officer and serve our public. We are getting large pools of applicants coming in. We are, through our selection process, those are very quickly whittled down to a fairly shallow pool, and we continually are having to do a better job of recruitment and marketing and branding the organization to get people to apply for law enforcement positions. We have been very, very fortunate, I believe, because of the culture of Hillsborough and the reputation of the Hillsborough Police Department, to have filled all of the recent police officer positions with very, very good qualified applicants. Lots with life experience, lots with four-year degrees and some education that we feel like is beneficial to the position. So I think we have been more successful than most, and we understand that we've been blessed in that situation.
Well, Deputy Chief Skinner, believe me, regardless of how anybody feels about this bill, we do appreciate everything you're doing.
And I appreciate
it. And your colleagues. I've said it before, I'm going to keep saying it.
Thank you, sir.
So thank you very much for coming today. All righty, and I'm going to call up Robert Davis and Pat Campbell, please. Let's finish off with these three. Whenever you're ready, gentlemen.
All right, if I may. My name is Robert Davis. I'm a police patrol sergeant and a member of the Beaverton Police Association. As a police officer for more than 18 years, a sergeant for 10 years, and former president of the Beaverton Police Association, I hope you will consider my perspective on this House bill. A lot of things that I have to bring up were already covered, so I won't waste your time on that. Something that I'm hearing little bits of is there's almost an implication that as a sergeant within the bargaining unit, that I'm not able to objectively discipline officers or scrutinize their behavior. And I got to tell you, I find that somewhat insulting. It's almost borderline questioning my integrity. And I'm here to tell you that overseeing officers within my bargaining unit, I actually scrutinize them and hold them to a higher standard than our management probably knows, for fear that they would tarnish the association that I've worked so hard to be a part of. So, again, I'm not going to cover the other things. I'll let Sergeant Campbell take over here.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Sergeant Campbell, Sergeant Pat Campbell. I've been a sergeant for the Beaverton Police Department for 11 years, and I'm in my 20th year of service with the City of Beaverton. Many of the points that have been made here this morning I won't cover, but I will touch on just several and very quickly. I think it's important to recognize that as a frontline supervisor, I am on the street more than my lieutenants, much more than the captains. I'm professionally exposed to much more liability than anybody above me in rank, and almost the same as the line patrol officers. I make arrests, I do traffic stops, I respond to calls. If the Hillsborough Sergeant, Sergeant Hess, I believe, he and I share a border. If we were involved in an incident one afternoon where it may involve a shooting, it may involve just a tussle where somebody gets hurt, and we needed representation, in 20 minutes on the east side of 185th, I have an attorney, and maybe he doesn't. I have somebody giving me advice about what to do, about how to handle things, and he might not. There is a difference between somebody who has the protection that I have and enjoy and someone that doesn't. I have avoided promotion on three different occasions for precisely the reasons that were previously mentioned. To lose that protection and to remain exposed is not something I would choose to do. Deputy Chief of Hillsborough mentioned that we're all having trouble recruiting people. I can tell you from talking to these young people that come to our agency that their number one concern is, am I going to lose my house? Is my livelihood at risk here? How do I avoid that? My son and daughter recently graduated college and wouldn't think to become police officers, not because they're not proud of what I do, but because they know the kind of risk that they're going to expose themselves to. And the protection I enjoy with the association that I'm with is important. And it gives me the confidence and the ability to do my job to the fullest and feel comfortable that as long as I follow the rules and the protocols, I'm covered. I can tell you that I do, as a sergeant, I don't hire, I don't transfer, I don't promote, I don't suspend people, I don't discharge them. And I don't even schedule officer shifts. As a line supervisor, however, I do direct what they do. I do follow the rules and the protocols, and I do carry out the wishes and the directives of my command staff. The mission statement of the city and my police department is in my best interest, and I do what I'm asked to do, and I am the association president only recently. But I have no issues and no problems separating what the department and the city wants me to do and the vested labor interests of the people that I represent. When Sergeant Davis mentioned to me in the back row that he was going to bring up the notion that he was upset that somebody would question his integrity, I couldn't agree with him more. That someone would come to me and say, Sergeant Campbell, how do I know the investigation you did on that criminal complaint against Officer Burke, that you weren't biased? I would be insulted if somebody presented that to me. I do a good job. I do investigations. I do them fairly. I do them objectively. I do them without bias. And even though they're reviewed, and even though the ultimate discipline is handed down by somebody else, I'm able to present the facts as they are. And my affiliation with an association does not affect that at all. I can tell you that the notion that I would not have that protection, and I've thought about this many times, would actually and probably force me to request a demotion to patrol. I am well respected by the people that I work with. Any officer that I work with can tell you that they would follow me anywhere. And it has nothing to do with association or representation or association affiliation. It has to do with who you are. And I think if you can trust the sergeants that to do the right thing, and we will do the right thing, especially here in Oregon, especially at the Beaverton Police Department, there would be no need to remove that protection from me. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, these gentlemen?
Well, I think you've made your point quite well. Thank you, guys.
Thank
Keep
you.
Up the good work.
Thank you.
All righty, then. I'm going to call Scott Westerman, Daryl Gerritsen, and Mark Makler. I hope I pronounced that right, Mark. These are the last three I have on the list. If anyone else wants to testify after these folks are done, let me know.
Mr. Chairman, could we also bring up Jeff Leedy, the president of the Oregon
State? Well, I think we could probably allow for that, yes.
Thank you.
Why not? Just grab another chair there and drag it up here.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Daryl Gerritsen. I'm an attorney. I've been practicing law for 33 years with the firm of Gerritsen, Gallagher, Fenwick, and Mackler.
It looks like it's raining out there.
It is, and I had to go plug my meter. We represent, I think, 110 now labor organizations, independent labor organizations, predominantly in the public safety arena. I've been handling public safety labor for almost the entire time, with 14 years on the management side before I saw the light and decided to represent truth, justice, and the American way. That aside, I want to talk a little bit about the process. The sergeants from Lincoln County expressed some concern that somehow they would be forced into a bargaining unit. That's not the way the process works. You file a petition for a unit clarification. To file the petition, you have to have what's called showing of interest cards by sergeants or whatever rank you're seeking to add to a bargaining unit of people who want to come in. It requires at least a 30% showing to just get your petition filed. If the employer objects, you go to hearing. Let's assume that after the end of the hearing, it's found they're not supervisors. There's still an election, unless you have over 50%. So no sergeants are going to be forced into a bargaining unit unless a majority of the sergeants want to come into a bargaining unit. But more fundamentally, the question for you and the reason that this bill is before you is the way the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act is defined is if you're a supervisor, you have no right to organize, period. You have no right to be able to, as a collective body, negotiate with your employer over the conditions of employment, pure and simple. So at what point do you draw the line where you say you, because of the job duties you perform, have no right to organize and petition and bargain with your employer? That's simply what we're here for. And we believe that Senate Bill 750 defined that line too low and left a class of public employees in a position where basically they are at the whim of their employer. And if their employer treats them well, they're not going to file to come in. And if their employer doesn't treat them well, they will. The last thing I want to mention is managers have presented a list of what I call the parade of horribles. Divided loyalty, oh, we won't be able to fulfill the mission, etc. All you have to do is look on the other side of the river. In the state of Washington, sergeants have been in public safety bargaining units since its inception. They continue to be in public safety bargaining units, and I believe you will not find any cases of the parade of horribles occurring on that side of the river. And, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Hi, my name is Scott Westerman. I'm the president of the Portland Police Association. I'm also a sergeant with the Portland Police Bureau. And I appreciate Mr. Chair and members of the committee for being here. The majority of what I had to say has already been spoken, so I'll keep it very, very short. As all of you know, the position of police officer, or the police work in the entire country for that matter, the lowest ranking person is the person who makes the most life and death decisions on a daily basis. And that decision changes as you go up the rank and becomes much more diminished. Patrol officers on the street are the first ones who handle a scene. They take control. The first officer on the scene is the person who is in charge until a sergeant gets there. And only then, after the sergeant's been briefed. And at that point, that sergeant's in control of the scene, no different than the on-scene officer is, no different than a training officer is with a coach. They are there to help direct what happens on the scene, period. They do not make management decisions. The liability that is there is equal amongst all sergeants and officers across the board, and in many cases, sergeants have much greater responsibility because there can be times where a sergeant can actually dictate the use of force that an officer has to deploy. And those are the areas that the protections for supervisors are necessary. Now, I've listened to the testimony, and I would submit that the two sergeants from Lincoln County in my department would be lieutenants and would not be considered along what we're dealing with here. In my department, it's officer to sergeant, sergeant to lieutenant, lieutenant to captain, and continuing up the rank from there. So a patrol sergeant on the street is just a frontline supervisor. That's it. They do not make decisions. When it comes to management rights, they do not transfer people. They do not impose discipline. When they do investigations on officers that are in their tenure, it's what we call service complaints, which are ones that would not likely lead to discipline. They're ones for purposes of improving the servants of our department to our community. And when they do that, they still do not make final recommendations. Again, it's no different than a police officer on the street who goes to a crime scene, listens to all persons, writes down what happened and forwards it to the district attorney's office for review. A sergeant in our department writes down the incident as it occurred, documents all the things, and then presents it to management for a decision. Management makes those decisions, and that's the distinction that I would like to make for our department. Having been the president of the Portland Police Association only since November and only being a sergeant for the last 2 years and having been in law enforcement for over 20 years now, having supervisors within our bargaining unit in our department has actually helped dramatically the communication level between the chief's office and the patrol shifts. In fact, so much so that the city of Portland has chosen to keep sergeants within its bargaining units and has not chosen to exercise its rights under the old rules to change that. And I think that that is a very, very key point that the largest police agency in the state sees the value in keeping sergeants within the bargaining unit. I believe that's all I have for now.
Chair, if I may, before...
If you wish.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a little confused. Sergeant, thank you. We've heard testimony that sergeants don't have the ability to organize in previous testimony just before yours.
That's correct.
Are you a sergeant?
Yes, sir.
Are you organized?
Yes, sir. The previous bill, Senate Bill 750, gave the city the right to strip that from agencies, and certain departments such as Hillsborough and other departments have done so.
It was permissive, not mandated.
That's right. The city of Portland has chosen not to do that because they see the value in having sergeants stay in a collective bargaining. This would just basically make the legal statute say for the, and then my interest in this is that the city of Portland would not be able to say at the next contract, no, you're out, which they could do.
So today, cities have the flexibility to allow their sergeants to organize if they so choose. It's in the best interest of their local communities.
That's correct.
Thank you.
In my humble opinion, I think this was just an attempt to get as few people out of collective bargaining as they could. That's my as many people out of collective bargaining. That's my humble opinion, and I'm biased. I'm not out there being unbiased and objective. I am biased, and I don't have any problem admitting it. Jeff, go ahead.
Chair Schauffler, members of the committee, it's hard for me to put a finer point on this issue than what you've already heard, but I'll give you a little perspective about my department, which is the Oregon State Police. I've been a trooper.
Mr. Lady, did you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I did not. My name is Jeff Leedy. I'm a senior trooper with the Oregon State Police, and I'm president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I took judicial notice that you would probably know that. As I said, it's hard for me to put a finer point on what you've already heard here, but I'd like to give a little bit of perspective from my department. I've been a police officer or trooper for 23 years. I'm now a senior trooper. In my department, sergeants are no longer in our bargaining unit. They were at one time. A lot of it, right now, to become a sergeant with the Oregon State Police, you have to have 5 years on. And if you'll notice from the, if you'll remember the form I gave you the other day on the pay parity issue, you'll notice how far behind those people are at 5 years. the only incentive to become a sergeant for anybody is if you have about 5 to 6 years on, because after that, it's a pay cut. And we'll talk about overtime. Our sergeants don't get overtime. They were in patrol offices, they can work up to 60, 70 hours a week. And if I work that 60, 70 hours a week, I'm going to make a heck of a lot more than my sergeant is. But their actual goal that I see is I want the most senior, experienced, qualified people becoming patrol sergeant, because they're out on the street with our young, very young members. And while many people with only 5 years experience can do it, I work with people, and I'll throw his name out. There's a member of my board by the name of Ken Snook. He's been on about 2 years longer than I have. He's been there. He's done it. There's nothing he hasn't seen or can't handle. But he can't go up for sergeant. He cannot accept that pay cut. Recent events last week are probably going to swell my members from recently promoted sergeants, because they just all took a pay cut, and they're going to take another one. And they need to be represented. I need, when I have the most qualified, experienced people out on the street supervising troopers, my disciplinary problems go way down. And that's an added expense to the department as well. I don't have anything else. If you've got any questions.
Go ahead, sir, please.
Thank you. Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, my name is Mark Mackler, and Daryl's my partner. He and I, with the rest of the attorneys from our firm, represent about 125 different public safety agencies in Oregon and Washington. As Daryl pointed out, I'm not going to repeat a lot of the things that you have heard. I do have a letter that I'd like to submit that's an appeal for a lieutenant from the Beaverton Police Department from 2005. It relates to that lieutenant's authority to make disciplinary decision issues. Now, you heard from the two sergeants in Beaverton who are in the association. This lieutenant was not and is not represented. I need to point out the following, which is why this is being submitted. This change that we're asking for is about the fundamental things that Will Aitchison talked about at the beginning of the session. It still is about choice. It still is about the ability of these people with this change to the statute to decide whether or not they want to organize to be in, as Daryl pointed out. It also provides that the determination and the definition about whether or not supervisor is tied to the ability to actually exercise independent judgment and authority. And that is, again, something, as you've heard talked about, and you've listened to the Lincoln County sergeants, you've listened to the Hillsborough police officer, the deputy chief, and the Beaverton police sergeants, is you can see, and as was pointed out by some of the representatives of the committee, we are all over the map in this state. And this bill, this change, will help us be able to delineate where that line is, so that those first-line supervisors are not necessarily, objectively, and lawfully excluded unless they have the independent ability to make decisions on behalf of their employer. Thank you.
Yeah, just so I get my hands around this too. This bill, if it passes, if the sergeants in Hillsborough are happy, they do not have to be organized. If the sergeants in Lincoln County are satisfied with the structure, they do not have to be organized. If there is a sergeant within one of those departments, or in a department that is organized, that does have administrative duties that are outside of the on-the-street duties, then that person, a confidential, I believe the word was used, that person would be excluded from the bargaining unit as well, correct? So there's tremendous amount of flexibility within this. And the Portland, they all decided to just stay the way it was, even in light of Senate Bill 750, because of the structure that they were enjoying at that time. Do I got all that gathered up in my brain?
Chair Schaffler, yes, you do.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions, Representative Cameron?
Yeah, thank you very much for your testimony today. And you just had a key phrase on the last page of the bill when you said independent. You said independent ability. The bill says independent authority.
Go ahead.
Can you tell me what independent authority means?
Independent authority are, Chair Schaffler, Vice Chair Campbell. Independent authority, the ability, as you've heard, hiring, firing, independent judgment. And the letter that I have given you that is an appeal, I think speaks well to this issue. If you choose to read it, I realize it's lengthy, as it happened for an unrepresented employee, and we appealed directly to the city manager / mayor and human resources director. But it is the ability to make a decision and then have that decision stick without somebody else telling that person who made the decision that it's being overridden and changed. And while we can argue all the way up to the top, and some people will do, and you'll hear the management argument, which is ultimately that may just be the city manager or the chief, that's potentially the case in a lot of organizations. It appears that in Lincoln County, as we heard from the sergeants there, that they are given independent authority to hire and fire. And as the PPA president, Scott Westburn, points out, that makes them a lieutenant in Portland, potentially. It may make them a lieutenant in Hillsborough. It may make them a commander in Hillsborough. But independent authority is the ability to make a decision with regard to the hiring, firing, adjusting economic grievances, imposing economic discipline, authorizing a whole host of issues without somebody coming back and saying, you did wrong, and now I'm going to hold you accountable and take issue against you.
A follow-up, if I may. Please. So let's use a sergeant over in Lincoln County, for example. Let's say they made a decision to fire an employee, but it was overturned. So now do they fall underneath this because they couldn't exercise their independent authority?
Overturned by whom?
By the chief or by the sheriff?
I don't know. You're asking Chair Schaffler and Chair Cameron. I don't know the... I'll let Daryl answer in a second, but I don't know the structure of the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office and whether or not, as I listen to the sergeants speak to their authority, whether or not the sheriff can actually overturn that. I assume the sheriff can, because ultimately it is his or her watch.
Thank you.
Ultimately.
If I may, even if that were the case, the sergeants would still have to come and say, well, we want to be in the bargaining unit. Even in that scenario that was just spelled
Chair,
out.
Chair Schaffler, Vice Chairman Cameron, if I may, the bill returns to prior ERB precedent. Prior ERB precedent in evaluating whether or not you indicate whether or not you exercise independent judgment or independent authority takes into account the fact that decisions may be overturned, but it looks at the procedure or the process as a whole. So that if the sheriff routinely overturns the decisions of the sergeants, they would not be found to be supervisors. If the sheriff occasionally overturns the decision of a sergeant, that sergeant still exercises independent authority. Does that help?
Sure.
Just so I get this squared away, you got a bunch of sergeants who aren't in the bargaining unit. They have supervisory duties and abilities that can be overturned by a higher up. That does not automatically organize them. They have to collectively vote to be organized.
Correct.
That change of that decision doesn't automatically put them in a collective bargaining unit.
Mr. Chair, if I may, to address Vice Chair Cameron's position, just to kind of make the point a little bit clearer, for the Portland Police Bureau, sergeants are not able to make that decision. When we do an investigation, we do a finding on an internal thing, we submit the facts. We, sergeants, are not even allowed to make a recommendation as it relates to that. We just represent the facts. A lieutenant is the first rank in which that ability is garnered. In other words, the lieutenant is able to sit there and say, I recommend a sustained complaint and I recommend termination. That is a division that I see is very paramount here as far as frontline supervisor versus management. A lieutenant is able to expend monies. A lieutenant is able to impose discipline, financial, economic punishment. Sorry. A sergeant is not. In our department. And that's the line that I see as being the most important here when it comes to articulating what your point was. Even if a lieutenant may be overridden higher up the chain, a sergeant's not even allowed to make that recommendation.
Sure. I understand that. Yeah. And you described, excuse me.
Yes, go ahead.
And you described that is the facts in Portland, and also you're under collective bargaining in Portland as a sergeant.
That's right? Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions of this panel? We're going to thank you guys. Thank you very much for your service and everything you do, believe me. We're going to wait and get some more information on this and bring this bill back to you today.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2633. Anything for the good of the order? All right, we're adjourned.